Function Room 48, Object Lesson. My guest is Katie Steckles, mathematician, presenter and communicator. She has written 7 books about mathematics. She hosts the brilliant Mathematical Objects podcast, where she and her co-presenter Peter Rowlett discuss often very everyday objects, and sometimes weird ones, and the mathematics behind and because of that object. Their guest will bring in their own object, and it all makes for a very entertaining discussion of objects, things we take for granted, and the maths behind them. It's the kind of podcast I would love to have made if I were cleverer and had thought of it first. It's a very interesting chat this week with Katie about Arbelot's kaleidocycles, bringing the stories of mathematics to light, the skill of not knowing what you're doing, Euclid's brother, Pythagoras's very existence, Jeff Goldblum, and a global maths communication hub built on a submarine in Katie's long-term plans and dreams. Again, apologies for the aperiodic nature of these podcasts. Pretend it's another era and the podcast got held up by winter storms and waited for the snows to melt. Anyway, it's fitting as Katie's website is called aperiodical.net. And she did that on purpose because it describes the lack of pattern in the frequency of their blog posts on that. So she knows my pain. Anyway, here's Katie.
I'm Katie Steckles. I am a mathematician, I guess, is probably the way I usually describe myself. And my job is, it's kind of hard thing to pin down because I'm sort of freelance and I do lots of different things, but probably a good umbrella term is maths communication. So I do, you know, bits of work around popularizing maths and kind of telling people about interesting bits of maths. I work a lot with schools and then I just do any number of other things. So I've done bits of TV, radio. I've just now finished writing my 6th popular maths book. And I've also done kind of, you know, theatre projects and art gallery residencies and world record attempts and anything and everything to do with kind of maths promotion.
That's a lot of stuff. 6 books, congratulations. What's the latest one about and why did you write it?
Well, so there's one I've literally just finished in the sense that I've just emailed the proofs back to the editor today. And that's a book from a series that's called In Graphics. So it's kind of, the idea is it's all based around pictures and diagrams and illustrations. And we've done 2 books. We've done one called Algebra in Graphics and one called Geometry in Graphics, because obviously math splits very neatly into algebra and geometry and there's no overlap whatsoever between those two things. Yes. It's really funny. We keep sending them stuff because the person who's writing the geometry book is a colleague of mine and we keep sending them stuff. And the publishers are like, oh, this was mentioned in the other book. And it's like, yeah, it's also part of geometry.
Yeah.
Like they're very much the same. But yeah, so there's been a lot of focus on kind of diagrams and illustrations in that one, which is sort of not what I'd usually do. Like it's more about the words usually. And that's been quite nice to sort of think about what's the best way to represent this idea and what kind of pictures can we put in here to make it more interesting. Geometry has had a lot of an easier ride than I have, to be honest, because on the algebra side, things tend to be a bit more abstract. But I think I've had a bit of fun with it. We've got some quite nice sort of illustrations of things in there. But yeah, that one's literally just gone in. Might be another few months before that one appears as a book. But the one before that that's just come out a month or so ago is called 100 Ideas in 100 Words.
Okay.
And it's part of, again, a series where they've got a maths one and all the other different subjects get their own copy. But that's one which I've written with 2 other mathematicians we've written a third of it each. And essentially, we had to pick 100 things that summarized the whole of maths,
okay,
which in itself was quite a big challenge. And then for each of them, we got like a 100-word summary that we had to write. And 100 is not a lot of words, it turns out.
No.
So we'd write the little summary and then we got a little bit of space on the other page to put a bit of context around it. But that was a really interesting one because it really kind of makes you focus on what's important about a topic and what you really need to say. But hopefully it kind of gives people a nice little overview that they can dip in and out of and sort of be like, oh, I've never heard of that. I'll look it up and read more. So,
and in the condensing of a mathematical idea to 100 words, did you learn anything about any mathematical ideas that you didn't know already?
I think so. We kind of split the topics between us and we, I think, maybe did a bit of like, oh, I'll take that one because I already know stuff about that. But inevitably, there's always going to be some stuff that we didn't kind of have in our wheelhouse already. So I think there were a few things that I was like, I've got a rough idea of what this is. And I think part of my work as a maths communicator means that people will come to me and say, can you do a talk about this topic? Or can you tell us more about this? Or can you do a radio interview about this maths news story? And I kind of need to have this sort of incredibly broad and very shallow knowledge of lots of different areas of maths. So basically anything you can name, I could tell you a couple of sentences about what that is and who uses it and what for. But for the 100 words, you kind of actually almost need to know more to be able to sort of get that overview and be able to say what is actually the important part of this and what do I really need to distill this down to.
Is there an area that you were really happy to bring more attention to as part of that 100 words and 100 ideas where you were like, finally I get to tell people a little about X, not X, literally, but...
Well, I mean, that could have been one of the topics, I guess, algebra as a topic. I think it was a nice sort of excuse to bring in some of the maths that people don't normally get to learn about at school. And I guess a lot of popular maths books are like, here's some stuff that you'll recognise and is familiar. But we were able to go into more things like sort of algebra, group theory, things like mathematical modelling and the way that's sort of done, geometry and topology and things that aren't really part of the school syllabus, and things like, four-dimensional shapes and all of this kind of stuff. So between the three of us, we were like, this is a really good spread. And there were always things that we were like, oh, I wish we had 101 so we could also put this in. But, I think we ended up settling on what we thought was a reasonable spread. I'm sure people will be able to pick holes in it if they have a look through the book. Why have you not mentioned this? But, it was cut something and add something else, I guess, so...
Something like topology strikes me as an area that it would be great fun to learn about much earlier. Some bits of maths are fascinating, but they're almost like the dessert we never get to have because we never finish our greens in time, and then we don't do any further maths again. So it is good to give people a glimpse of here's some math stuff that is in this area, Maybe it's stick at the broccoli for a while and you'll get to this. There's a reason why.
Yeah, it is a really interesting one because the nature of education is such that if you're teaching people at school, you kind of need to prepare them for if they wanted to do maths at uni or A-levels or whatever the equivalent is. Like there are certain things they have to know, I guess. And you can't really design a school curriculum that prepares someone who's going to go on and do a maths degree as well as someone who's going to go on and just do a bit more and then stop, as well as someone who's never going to look at maths again and is just going to go and take it off into their real like everyday life and use it for that, because they're all very different goals in terms of what a curriculum should look like, and yet all of these people are in the same classroom together. But as you say, it sort of feels like learning football by just dribbling a football between some cones for hours and hours, and that's not what football is. It's great practice, but it doesn't actually
You get to play matches in university.
Exactly. And kind of that would be a really weird way to teach kids football, I guess. It's like if you get good enough at dribbling between the cones, you can go and actually play football. The part of the work that I do, I guess, it's sometimes called enrichment, I guess, that you go to kind of school level students and say, okay, this is the stuff you're learning about now, and this is how you can use this same stuff to do more interesting things. Or here are some topics that you wouldn't necessarily normally get to meet. But this is kind of where this subject is going. And certainly for me, I know when I did maths at school, I was like, okay, this is a thing I can do. I get why people want it and it's useful. But then when I got to sort of age of 16, 17 and started doing A-level maths, I was like, I can see that this is cool now. There's more to this, and there's this whole kind of area out there. And I guess part of the stuff that I try and do is give people that insight into like where this subject can go and the fact that it's more than just arithmetic, which for a lot of people, they conflate the two things. And I always say arithmetic is spelling if maths is writing books and poetry, right? If you can do it, it helps, but it's not the whole thing at all.
Yeah, what popped into my head as you were talking about it there is like in Karate Kid where he has to do all the wax on, wax off.
Just getting the actual techniques right.
Yeah.
And obviously they're useful, right? They're great and they give you the skills and, knowing your times tables and being able to do calculations and stuff. If you're going on to do higher maths, if you don't have all of that stuff, you'll really struggle. But actually, and also those things are useful in daily life as well. but it's not inspirational in the way you would like it to be, yeah. I guess.
When do I get to do that kick from the top of the...
Well, exactly, yeah.
From the top of the pole. But, you know, it's not either or. What I like about what you do is you kind of acknowledge these are the different goals in education, and then the one size won't fit all. It has to fit many. Here's where I come in at an angle and tell you some, fill in some gaps for you to go at least that if you say you don't like maths or you're not going to do anything further with it, you're doing it from a position of, you know, I didn't like the stuff I was doing in school and I didn't like the stuff that Katie told me either. So I definitely don't like it.
Well, it's about, I guess, having a respect for it and like understanding what the point of it is. And obviously people are very welcome to go, that's not something I want to do with my life. But like understanding and appreciating that it's not just about kind of crunching calculations and you know, finding things really difficult, which is a lot of the experience that people have at school sometimes. It's just that this thing that they have to do that is hard, right? It's a difficult subject. You can't hide away from that. But actually, unless you've got a motivation to do it, it's really hard to kind of keep yourself going through that and keep battering away at things.
And going back to school, and in fact, probably going back to the earliest bits of school, is in a way leads me nicely to your Mathematical Objects podcast, because early in school, we physically play with stuff, we hold things, we look at them, and B, sometimes early childhood toys are mathematical objects. But just to take a step back, what is that podcast about? Who knew two podcasters interviewing each other? Has that ever happened before? But
I mean, almost certainly, yeah.
It was one of the things, it was one of the podcasts that inspired me to give this a go, to, you know, find a little niche for me to jump in and help. The idea that you could represent the visual in an audio way by listening to people describe an object that I can't see at the moment, but I'm going to look at differently the next time I see it. Anyway, tell us about Mathematical Objects.
Yeah, well, I think that's essentially it, that we wanted a kind of essentially an excuse to talk about some interesting maths in each episode of the podcast. And we thought if we pick an object that is the sort of focus for that episode, and it might be an object that's inherently quite mathematical, like a calculator or, you know, a particular shape. It doesn't have to be a real object. It can also be something, you know, abstract and hypothetical, or it could be something that's just like a real world object that actually there is some interesting maths behind it or underneath it. And then we just use that as a starting point to have a kind of mathematical chat. So it's myself and my colleague, Peter Rowlett, who's also a mathematician and maths lecturer at Sheffield Hallam. And the reason it came about essentially was because I also started lecturing at Sheffield Hallam, which I did for a few years. And we thought, oh, we're in the same place. We might as well sit down and record a podcast. And this was pre it being very easy to record a podcast over the internet, because, you know, video conferencing suddenly became a lot easier and a lot more everywhere. But the first couple of series, we literally booked a classroom somewhere on the campus and went hid away for a couple of hours and just recorded a bunch of chats. And it is genuinely, as you've described, the process of having to talk about an object that no one can see and describe it in enough detail for people to be able to understand what it is you're talking about was sometimes a real challenge. Like, we were like, what have we done? We've given ourselves this task. And sometimes it's like an object that everyone can picture because they've definitely seen one before. But then other times it was a thing that wasn't something familiar. Like, we had there's a mathematician called Kat Ag who does really good geometry puzzles online, and she came and talked about a shape that she was interested in telling us about called an arbolos, which is like a semicircle with two semicircles cut out of the bottom of it. If you can sort of picture that, then maybe not kind of the same size, so it could be a small one and a big one. And it is kind of a geometrically interesting shape, and she told us a bit about where she came across this and how she's written puzzles about it. And it was a really lovely episode, but we were just like, we need a picture of one.
Yeah.
Just in case anyone watching. So we have, with each episode, I guess there's like a link on the website, we have one image, and that's what we allow ourselves, is one kind of visual. And the theory is that people listening to the episode can look up that picture and stare at it while they're listening. And we've also started putting those on YouTube as well. So if you listen to it I understand some people listen to podcasts on YouTube, you just get the still image for the whole time. So I guess it's part of the challenge of it is kind of making the thing appear in someone's mind, which is sometimes easier than others.
And just for the benefit of, so as not to abstract another layer of audio for my listeners, an arbolos, I'm looking at it here, you could describe it as the shape maybe a parachute might make as you're hanging down
kind of, yeah, where the two sides are pulled down and there's a spot in the middle that's pulled down as well, or maybe not quite in the middle, but it's sort of made out of three curves.
And without repeating verbatim that episode, why does Katrina like an Arbalos?
So I think it's partly that when she kind of sets these geometry puzzles, so she often does things with, like, you know, some simple shapes like squares or circles or semicircles, and essentially just plays around until she finds a configuration that creates an interesting question. So it could be like, if this length is this, what's the area of this thing? And she's really, really good at designing these puzzles. And if you find them online, there's hundreds of them now, and she's produced like downloadable versions. I think she's done a couple of books as well that are just pages and pages of them. But they're just these really simple ideas. And I think this is a shape that's come up quite a few times because it's sort of semicircles out of semicircles. That kind of finding the area of it, I guess you'd need to work out the radii of the two smaller circles and the big circle and, you know, derive all the numbers you need. And then you can find the area of this shape.
But even something like that, you know, it could be for puzzle's sake, but also it's such a pleasing shape. It might be used in an ornamental garden or in a pattern. And then if it's a repeating pattern, you know, what's the area of cloth you might need to make this and that. So it's not for nothing. Like this stuff, it puzzles people for good reasons and into that amazing area, which I don't know anything about, but I know enough to know that I would be fascinated if I knew a bit more. The idea of how things fit together, or, you know, how you work out the area of weird shapes that happen to be nice designs.
Yeah.
And what is it, what makes the design nice, and what's the maths that makes it pleasing? That all that stuff is kind of, sometimes you get a glimpse into it and you go, oh, if I had more time and I was cleverer, I'd love this.
Well, it's the kind of thing that I feel like talking about things, especially with the podcast, like picking a particular thing and featuring it in that way, potentially has the possibility of making it more of a thing that people know about and talk about. And you know, you get it printed on a t-shirt, or you design, you know, some fabric patterns that incorporate the shape. And that would be a really nice outcome if you know, it becomes, the Arbalest becomes more famous and becomes a sort of a motif that's used in design. That would be really cool.
Yeah, and like also, it's something that I constantly try and tell myself, even though my brain rebels against, that it's totally okay to not have a clue what's going on the first time and then know a little bit the second time. Like the example I always use is when we were buying a buggy before our first child was born. It was so bewildering being in the shop with the 35 different types of baby buggy and being terrified of making the wrong decision. But then the second time we went to have a look, we were slightly less afraid of making the wrong decision. And I don't know, for some reason, that's become a metaphor for how to deal with complexity in like all my life.
Yeah, well, there's the standard, I think it's Andrew Wiles has this metaphor for what mathematical research is like. And he describes it as being in a room that's completely dark, and you can't see anything, and you're sort of walking around, stumbling into things and feeling your way along the walls. And you kind of get a mental map of where everything is in the room, and you kind of understand it a bit. And then eventually you find the light switch.
Yeah.
And you turn the light on and you turn around, and all the things that you kind of had a rough idea of in your head, you can now just see them all. And I guess this is like the moment where you prove a piece of math, or you discover something that kind of really clarifies it for you. I think it was also, I can't remember if it was Marion Mirzakhani, but one of the Fields medalists had a metaphor that was like, you're in a jungle, and it's when you get a helicopter and you can fly up and see the whole jungle. So it's that kind of nice idea that often, because, you know, as I've said, maths is hard. Like, you find yourself sort of hacking through something and you think, I don't really understand this. And it's kind of, you know, maths is more about persevering than it is about immediately getting stuff. Right, you have to just keep going and keep being okay with not understanding it fully until you get to the point where you can.
Yeah,
I guess.
As long as there isn't an exam like tomorrow.
Well, that's not what it's about, though, is it? Yeah. Right.
No.
Yeah.
Apart from Arbalest, do you have a favorite object on or off the show? That's off the podcast. That is, I don't know. The knowledge, knowing a bit more about it, there was such a return in the answer to a very simple question on it that you kind of looked at the object and went, wow, I really respect that object now.
Yeah, well, I feel like my favorite mathematical object or thing could probably change from week to week. Like, if you ask me that question, I'll be like, here's the thing I've just recently learned about that I think is really cool. And I think probably my latest one is a shape called a kaleidocycle.
Okay.
So if you've heard of a flexagon, this is like a flat object that you can kind of fold in different ways and essentially just show different faces on the same object. So flexagons are often made out of like a strip of paper or a piece of paper folded up. And it's the sort of thing where you can fold it in half and then unfold it in a different direction and get a different sort of surface on the outside. And it was one of these things that people played with a lot, made out of paper, obviously studied all of the possible configurations and shapes that you can make. And they're a fun little toy that you can build. And I guess you could ask the question, can we kick this up into 3D? And a collider cycle, which, to be clear, I believe should be called a flexahedron.
Right.
Because if it's a flexagon is a flat one, it should be a flexahedron. But for whatever reason,
here.
I know, for whatever reason, it's not called that. And it's called a collider cycle. And a friend of mine, Aileen McDonald, who does lots of cool math stuff on the internet.
She's been on this podcast.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Has recently introduced me to this as an idea. And basically, it's like a 3D shape, but you can kind of fold it inside itself and it pops out a different shape. I guess there's sort of a similar kind of idea that it's sometimes called an octopush, but it's 8 cubes that are joined at the edges in such a way that you can kind of flip it open and then turn it into a 2x4 rectangle of cubes and then fold it in half and get a different 2x4 and then you can fold it back into a cube again. And if you've ever played with one, it's like one of those really sort of fascinating fidget toys that you can just keep kind of flipping it around.
Even looking at the representation on, I just Wikipedia'd it here, it's not too dissimilar, or certainly one GIF that they show, it's not too dissimilar to, even my little daughters come home from school with these like little boxes and you ask it a question and you open
like the
it
paper.
Out.
Yeah, the foldy thing,
The foldy thing. Oh, yeah. Good, you have the scientific
term. Like a fortune teller
thing. The fortune teller thing, And what is it, pick a number, and then they open it and close it.
Yeah, you count the number of things, but it's kind of that sort of idea, but it's like a triangle, like everything's made out of tetrahedron, and they're kind of joined together at the edges.
Yes.
So you end up with this thing that can sort of flip inside out. And what's really nice about it is you look at it and you're like, oh, it's just made out of tetrahedra, cool. It turns out if you make one out of regular tetrahedra, it can't flex at all. It's just stuck. It's just six tetrahedra stuck together in a loop, and you can't actually fold it inside itself. So you need them to actually be very slightly isosceles. They're slightly longer in one direction, and it means there's different versions of it you can do, and you can do one that's six tetrahedra. You can do one with eight, I think, and various different configurations. But actually, the net of it is really simple. It's just like a rectangle that's divided up into rhombuses, and then you kind of wrap it round into a tube and wrap that round like a torus.
Yeah.
So it's this fascinating shape that obviously when you've made one, you just sit there playing with it for hours and hours. But we've been looking at like how you can produce one, how you could take a photo and map it onto the surface of one so that when you build a thing, it's got the photo on one face and like all of these fun things with it.
What does its shadow look like and all that kind of thing? Yeah.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, the shape is called a flex-tangle by the characters in the 2018 science fantasy adventure film A Wrinkle in Time. Which depicted a paper model. Paper toy suggested how space and time, we've got to get to space and time, how space and time could be folded to explain the magical travels of the story. So see, there we are now, we're in time travel.
Yeah, I almost wonder if there's like a flatland thing where if you're a two-dimensional person, you're like, oh, I know about flexagons, they're flat, I can deal with that. And then suddenly someone comes in with this and you're like, whoa, it's in an extra dimension.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So the next step obviously is the fourth dimension of the collider cycle, and then we're into time and...
Yeah.
Well, cool. Okay, right. I had not known. This is my what's the bare minimum of my promise in this podcast, and I assume for yours, although you deliver far more, is giving people a word to Google that there is no way that it's pure serendipity that they've been given this new word to even look up, and then that might take them down a pleasing rabbit hole of multi dimensions. So that's a favorite object, and if I ask you next week, you'll have another one.
Almost certainly, yeah.
Coming up after the break, a little bit more about Mathematical Objects Podcast, a glimpse of category theory. We speculate about Euclid's brother and the Pythagoras coffee shop, the mathematics of Jurassic Park, and Katie's plans for maths communication world domination. Is the podcast still in train? Like, there's a lovely library of them.
We've got 7 or 8 series, I think, maybe 8, already on the website. So we host it on a website that me and Peter both write for called The Aperiodical, which is a a maths blog, which does not promise to post with any amount of regularity, okay. which is why we call it the Aperiodical.
Very good.
And it's essentially a group of three of us who got together and decided it would be easier to write a third of a maths blog each than to write our own maths blogs. And that's now, oh gosh, that's maybe like 12, 13 years old. We've been running that blog. And we're sort of keeping it going, but that's where we host the podcast. And all of the past series are on there. We are talking about whether or not to start recording the next series because now I no longer work at the same university as Peter, but luckily we've got the internet so we can just record online.
Yeah.
And we've already kind of put down some ideas for people we might invite onto another series because we always have, I think we do 8 episodes in a series and it's kind of I bring a few objects, Peter brings a few objects, and we bring in some special guests to talk about objects. And it's always hilarious because sometimes the object that they're coming in to talk about, they've actually just got a piece of mass they want to tell us about, but we have to pick an object to hang it on. Yeah. So we did one of my favourite episodes.
Bring in a dog or something.
Yeah, well, yeah. One of the best episodes we've done was with Ben Orlin, who's it does a blog called Math with Bad Drawings. He's like an American teacher. And I've kind of worked with him on a few other projects. We were like, Ben, do you want to come and talk about your new book? Because he's just done a book about, games. And it was just a big, massive book of mathematical games that you can play on pen and paper or whatever. And the object that we picked was fingers, because a few of these games were games where you kind of hold up different numbers of fingers. And we talked a little bit about maths and fingers and about counting systems and different historical uses of finger counting and that sort of thing. But it was great because I was like, so today's object is fingers. And I don't know enough about this subject, so I'm bringing in an expert. It was a really lovely episode. It's one of my favorite ones we've done, that one.
And in the area of maths, is there an area, I suppose you hinted at topology, that you were glad to bring it into the book 100 Maths Ideas in 100 Words. Is there an area that's completely esoteric and off the wall that you've always had a kind of a sneaking fascination with, that maybe it's the leap to actually for the plain people like me to understand is too much, but it's just mad. Like it's an area that is almost like magic or something.
Yeah, I think for me that would probably be something like category theory. And I kind of came up against this a couple of times at uni because people describe it as being the maths of maths, yeah. right? So it's this kind of theoretical underlying structure that actually underpins everything in maths. And it's so funny because, you learn about maths and you're like, oh, maths just underpins everything. It's great. It's all of science and all of engineering and all of these other things have got mathematical structures under them. And then like, no, that's not the bottom. Like you can go one level more abstract than that and just have thing and thing from thing to thing. And that's category theory.
It's turtles all the way down.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I'm kind of, I've known a few people who've done research in category theory, and I've seen at least one seminar given about it, and just the amount of it that I've managed to absorb. What I should do actually is read. So Eugenia Cheng is a category theorist and a popular maths writer, fantastic speaker. And she's done, I think, a book that is basically secretly a way of getting category theory out there. So I think I've got a copy somewhere, but I haven't managed to open it yet. This is the curse of being a maths popularizer, is that you get all these popular maths books either for yourself or through being sent copies of things, and they all just sit there waiting for you to have a free minute. That I think might be a nice sort of way into that. So if anyone else is interested in getting into category theory, Eugenia Cheng's books are probably the way to do it. My understanding is that it kind of gives you this slightly more overarching view of all of maths and the way that different bits of maths connect together, which sounds really cool.
Very good. We will, I'll mention that in the notes, and then a shout out to all category theorists there. Do you think there's an object somebody can bring in?
That'd be nice to do an episode.
Podcast. Yeah,
well, yeah, because essentially it's objects and arrows, right? A category theory. So do we do the object an object? Just go super meta? I don't know, maybe.
Okay, well, the challenge is there. I'm sure somebody listening will have a thing they can bring in or email in or, I don't know, post it in DHL, whatever it is. I suppose one of the things I like about books like yours and other popular maths books is the stories that go with it, because we sometimes kind of see maths as just, okay, well, it was inevitable they were going to make that discovery, and then they made that discovery, and then the guy was old and he had a beard, and then he found this eventually, and then everything was inevitable but very little of the lives they were leading while trying to do this. Is there a mathematician that is somebody that you find fascinating, not just because of what they found in maths, but because of the type of person they were?
I mean, there's a lot, right? There's so many cool people. And I guess what's interesting is that modern mathematics, there's a lot more people to kind of talk about. Obviously, historically, you only really hear about the super famous ones that did lots and lots of work. But actually, modern mathematics, there's so many more people doing it. But actually, the stuff they're doing is so much less easy to understand because it's kind of at this higher level of research. You know, back in the day when, you know, Euclid and Pythagoras were discovering things, there was a lot more low-hanging fruit, I'm going to say. Not that they weren't clever, obviously. There's still some great important work there, but it just feels a lot more like, really? We do that in primary school now. Whereas nowadays, you know, a top maths researcher like, you know, Terry Tao or Tim Gowers or someone like Mario Mizukani, like, you can't even get to the start of explaining what their research is about and what kind of stuff they do all day. But actually, Tim Gowers is pretty cool on social media. I think I follow him on previously Twitter and maybe now Mastodon. And he just occasionally comes out with some great pearls of wisdom. So I think, yeah, I like the idea that current research mathematicians are also people. And having worked in a maths department and done a PhD, I've met some people, many of whom are continuing to be research mathematicians and continuing to be cool people. So,
Time, of course, has a habit of filtering away all the people who were around Euclid or Newton as well. Like that old kind of urban myth about how, you know, Maradona had a friend who was a better footballer than him, or, you know, like Euclid had might have had a brother who was way better at triangles, but was hopeless at finishing projects. And we'll never find out about him. He doesn't make it in, he or she, in fact, doesn't make it into the history books. But even, I suppose, looking at modern mathematicians through the lens of the whole person, hopefully that will filter back. We find out more about the people that we previously only see as thumbnail black and white.
Yeah, but I guess if you go far back enough in history, there just isn't the knowledge, right? We don't have a record of any of these things. And one of the things that Peter has said previously, I think possibly on the podcast or if not somewhere nearby, that, like, for example, Pythagoras, we have this image of Pythagoras as this guy, but actually there's not very much known about him at all, really. And, you know, there was the cult of Pythagoras or the Pythagoreans. Like, none of the results that came out of that were necessarily actually Pythagoras. It could have just been someone else who was part of the group that came up with it. And then it gets put out as a Pythagorean discovery and everyone's like, oh, wow, Pythagoras did all this stuff. But, you know, it was a huge gang of people. And Peter said at one point, we're not even 100% sure whether Pythagoras was a person or whether they were just called the Pythagoreans or whether, like, the, you know, they used to hang out at Pythagoras's coffee shop and that's why everyone called them the Pythagoreans. Or, you know, like, it's so far back in time. And
Or was it like the ancient Minoan word for triangle? So basically, well, it's just the triangle people.
And, like, you know, I say maths is hard. History is even harder, right? The idea that you have to, like, find these scraps of knowledge. And, you know, when you pick that up, I mean, thinking about how much of what you read nowadays is potentially true or not true. Like, can you even trust a historical source when you find one? And you can only really just guess sometimes at what's really going on. So, yeah, the kind of history of maths is something that I've done a little bit of, in the sense that I've got a few talks where I talk about historical mathematicians, but I'm fully aware that maths historians do incredible work in kind of piecing all this stuff together. And it is fascinating because all of these people were real people, right? And, you know, Pythagoras presumably had a personality and if he existed, obviously, you know, was a particular kind of person, and there's not really any way to know. So,
yeah. And the thing is, because if we put people literally sometimes on pedestals, we then misjudge our own attempts to emulate them because we've no idea in what circumstances they discovered a thing or found a thing or how many people they had helping. So we put too much emphasis on genius and insight and maybe less on sheer grind and iteration and failure and leaving it and coming back and going for a walk and getting an idea.
Even on a sort of smaller level, like people who are studying maths at uni, like when I've done bits of lecturing and things, you kind of find that the students have this impression of what a mathematician is. And it's like someone who just walks in and immediately answers all the questions and does stuff right first time. And they look at themselves and their own experience and their own kind of progress through maths. And they think, oh, you know, I'm doing really badly. I must not be cut out to be a mathematician. And it's really tough because you kind of want to get across to them, actually being stuck, making a mistake, doing it wrong. All of these things are fully normal and part of the process. And if anyone tries to tell you otherwise, then they're lying, because, you know, maths is difficult and you can't like expect to be able to do it straight away. And you hear about these sort of genius figures and you think, oh, they must have been really intelligent and just able to do everything first time. But you don't hear about their mistakes and the things that they had to throw in the bin and start again. So it's like that Instagram thing where you only see the nice photos that people share, right?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have the full picture. And one of the things we did actually while I was lecturing, we had for one of the modules we were teaching, we realized there was going to be a spare lecture in the semester. And we thought, what can we do that's going to be useful to the students? Like, we've planned all the content, but we've got this one extra session. And we did essentially a session about mistakes and about being wrong. So we gave them some materials about like ways to find mistakes and how to check your working more carefully, and sort of techniques for, you know, you find the answer to a thing and then you plug it back in to check whether or not the value works or that kind of thing. And we also did, we got me and one of the other lecturers to do some unseen maths problems. So we pulled out some A-level maths papers, and essentially, without having seen them before, we just got the question and stood in front of the board and literally just tried to solve it on the fly in front of everyone. And it was just fascinating, both for us and for them, I think, because they'd never seen a lecturer struggle with something. And it was like maths that was below the level that we had learned maths to, but stuff that we hadn't really looked at for like 5 or 10 years. And I was like, we were using all our good problem solving techniques, like, oh, I'll draw a diagram, or I'll do this, or this, that, and the other. But I kept having to sort of look up formulae on my phone and trying to remember how things worked. And there were times where I was like, that can't be right. I must have done something wrong somewhere.
Yeah, all while battling the rising wave of panic.
Yeah, well, exactly. And you know, maths is a stressful thing sometimes as well, especially with an audience, it turns out. But for the students, it was really interesting because they're used to seeing lecturers who've got like a prepared set of notes that they're just effectively copying off. And they very rarely see you actually live processing and thinking about maths. And I think for some of them, it was actually quite useful to be like, that's what it's like when I do maths. So obviously it's not me that's doing something wrong. This is just what maths is like. But at the same time, you're kind of walking that tightrope because you also want them to respect you as a lecturer and believe the things you're saying. So it was sort of like, to be completely clear, this is now us switching into unseen problem mode. Like, this is what it's like. We've never seen a thing before. Obviously we do understand this stuff. And if you gave us 10 minutes to go away and, you know, think through this properly, we could come back and talk you through this problem. No worries. But as it stands, you're watching the live process of someone actually doing a thing. And I think the thing we tried to model most was our techniques for trying to reduce the number of mistakes we made, and our techniques for checking and kind of sense checks and that sort of thing, because that's the thing that you really need, right? It's not about doing it right first time. It's about being able to tell when what you've got is clearly not the right answer and figuring out where you went wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the skill you have to develop, I guess, to persevere in maths.
I had a question here about what is your dream job? You have so many of them. Is there something that time, money, being no object, that you'd love to do in this area, either something that you're already doing and you want to do more of, or actually what I'd really like to do is find a new subatomic particle, or, you know, push the boundaries of maths? Like, does the popularizer feel the draw back to doing unpopular maths?
Well, I think there was definitely a point in my career, like at the end of my PhD, that I was like, I've done some research. I know what that's like now. I'm all right not doing any more. That's fine. I mean, that's enough for me. And I, you know, I did my thesis and we published a paper off the back of that. But then at that point, I was so into the sort of mass communication side of things that it was kind of building up into a proper career. I was like, this is now my thing. And I think the thing that I'm really enjoying is not just the doing the mass communication, but it's the kind of building and facilitating other people doing mass communication. So I do bits of training, like I run training sessions on how to communicate maths well, and you know, different specific types of mass communication, like busking training and that kind of thing. And it's really good to sort of get other people who are passionate about the subject and want to communicate it. And not just in the same way that I do, where I'm kind of going to schools or talking at science festivals, but like people who do research and have got these really interesting stories to tell, and kind of helping them and facilitating them getting that out there into the world. So I have this sort of secret dream project, essentially, where I build a mass communication hub that's like an office space and people can come and co-work there and work on mass communication projects together. And obviously it's got like a little fab lab with a 3D printers and laser cutters and a podcasting studio and a YouTube studio and all of the kind of facilities that you need to do all these different kinds of projects that I work on. And I don't know where I would locate this because all the people I work with in mass communication live literally all over the country and sometimes all over the world, but somewhere convenient for everyone, let's say, that people could just come by and we'd have different people there each day and we could all chat and share ideas and kind of network and that kind of thing. That would be a really nice thing to be able to do, but obviously huge budget and not really much return on it as an investment. It's just a money sink.
The return will be the laughter of the children as they watch. So people arrive in clutching a sheaf full of papers on which are scribbled their work, and then they leave with a 15-minute TED talk about topology or category
theory.
That's
the idea, yeah.
That sounds like a great path to world domination. So hopefully this thing will be on an island somewhere.
Or just like a boat, like a big aircraft carrier or something that converts, and wherever it pulls in, that's where we're doing mass communication that day.
Just on that, the way things are, seeing as I'm quoting movies and as you were talking about the person coming in, solving something on the blackboard, which is a real movie trope, just to spring this one on you, do you have a favorite maths movie or maths in fiction that you've come across as a way, oh, they've done it right, or it's off the wall, but at least they've drawn people's attention to, well, what we were talking about last week, the three-body problem or something like that?
I guess the one that I often talk about is Jurassic Park. Which is, you know, for me within my lifetime, very much a reference that I resonate with. And it turns out just still works. You know, I've spoken to audiences of current teenagers, and this is a film that came out potentially quite a long time before they were born, and they've all seen it.
Yeah.
So like and I've read the book as well. And, you know, it's a thing that has just kind of made its way into popular culture. But the thing about Jurassic Park is there's a character in it that's a mathematician, and it is the coolest person you can possibly imagine. Right. So Jeff Goldblum.
Yes.
I think he describes himself at one point as a chaotician, which as far as I'm aware is not a thing. But I believe
but
it's like something in dynamics, something in that sort of area. And he's literally just this leather jacket, cool, like super chilled out guy who just comes in and he's looking at this situation they've got in Jurassic Park, and he's basically able to very quickly intuit this is going to go off the rails. And it's sort of the theory of mathematical chaos. And if you look at the novel, like the original paperback novel, at the start of each chapter, they've put in an iteration of the dragon curve, which is a fractal that sort of gets more complex as you iterate it. And it's literally on the sort of chapter title page for each chapter. And underneath it, there's a quote from the fictional mathematician Ian Malcolm about sort of the nature of systems and chaos and the way that, you know, in the absence of structure, things will break down. And that, you know, I guess the idea is that this thing that they've set up in Jurassic Park, there are too many variables that they don't have control of, and that the people who think that they've got this nice sort of self-contained, well-controlled, obviously park full of dinosaurs, who thought that was going to be safe? Literally the most terrifying lizards known to history. But that actually that is not going to go the way they're planning for it to go. And I mean, I don't want to spoil the end of the film, but he was right. So like, you know, it's sort of quite a nice nod to the fact that mathematics is sometimes used to describe real world systems and make predictions like weather forecasting and all this kind of stuff. And that's literally the area of dynamics. But in the film, he's just this super cool guy who almost immediately gets attacked by a dinosaur and spends a lot of the film sat like on morphine in the corner, just continuing to be incredibly cool. And he turns up in some of the later films as well. So that's my favorite fictional mathematician, I think.
Thanks a million for that. It's time for a reappraisal of Jeff Goldblum's role as a vector in popularizing maths. Because I did an episode of this podcast about maths in the movies, and I, to my shame, didn't include that. I was too basic and just went for stuff where clearly maths was practically in the title. Can't believe I neglected to mention Jurassic Park and the dragon curve and chaos and all that. I'm going to look at it with new eyes now. What's next for you if you're not, while you're waiting for the funding from a shadowy global organization to build your maths comms hub?
Well, all the fingers are crossed, yeah. Any day now, that's going to happen. Well, I've got, I'm always kind of shifting between different projects. There's one thing that I'm going to start working on again this year that will hopefully continue for a little while, and that's a website called MathsGear. which I used to be involved in. And when I say used to be involved in, I mean that when Maths Gear first started, it's an online shop that sells maths toys. And for first few months, it was literally just me putting things in envelopes in my spare room and putting them in a postbox. And then eventually we got a proper kind of office space and a warehouse and all of that kind of stuff. So it sells like mathematical toys and curiosities. So it's Matt Parker, who does lots of maths popularization, and Steve Mould, who's also big on YouTube and does maths and sciencey things. And between them, they kind of just wanted, there were a lot of things that they wanted to exist, but that you couldn't currently buy anywhere. And they were like, let's just make our own shop that sells these things. So it was a bit of like getting stuff manufactured and talking to, you know, companies that fabricate things about how could you make a dice with the wrong spots on, or how could you make, you know, a shape that's got constant diameter in all three directions, and, you know, getting those things sort of produced and existing. And then, of course, all the logistics of setting up an online shop and running it and all that kind of stuff. And I was involved in that for a few years when it started up, and I've been away from it a little bit doing other things, but I'm going to start with them again this year as the sort of product development role.
Very good.
And it's actually me and Aileen are going to work on this together and basically just come up with new ideas for things to sell there. So
brilliant.
You'll see lots of new things appearing on the website, potentially lots of ridiculous ideas that we haven't had time to put together. We will now actually be able to do that.
Armed with 7 series worth of objects from the Mathematical Objects podcast. Yeah. And what is it now? We're in late May. So hopefully getting to market in time for the Christmas maths toy boom.
Well, fingers crossed. Yeah, that's the hope, I guess. Yeah.
I'll have my pre-orders in. I'll sign up anyway, and I'll have my profile built, and then I'll await the Arbalos and Towers of Babel.
Yeah, Arbalos on a t-shirt. That's going straight on there. Yeah.
Sorry, not Tower of Babel, Tower of Hanoi, isn't it? Towers of Hanoi. Yeah, very good. Okay. Thank you so much for coming in to the function room, Katie Steckles. Best of luck with your various paths to world maths communication domination, and look forward to hearing and seeing all the amazing stuff you make and say. Thanks a million for coming into the function room.
Thank you.
That's all from the function room this time, number 48. Some people like arbitrary milestones like 50, but I'm especially pleased about 48, a very interesting number, as everyone knows, a highly totient number. I don't know what that means. Thanks to Katie. Best of luck to her in her quest for ultimate mathematics communications hub domination. So things that got mentioned, and you could look up to find out more. Andrew Wiles, he's the man who solved Fermat's Last Theorem. Tim Gowers is an expert in combinatorics. Terence Tao, childhood genius who kept getting better and is a huge force in mathematics communication. And also the late Mariam Mirzakhani, field medal recipient from Iran. We heard about the Jurassic Park dragon curve and chaos theory. It's all to do with fractals, and I'm going to do lots more on that eventually. But enough for this time. As usual, if you like what you hear, tell your friends, the ones you can talk to about this kind of thing, and follow me on Instagram, Colm O'Regan Comedy, or Twitter, Colm O'Regan. Bye-bye.